Namaste. So, as part of the series on collected works of the mother, today we take up volume 5. Probably we'll do it in two parts. Actually, I would like to do each of the volume in multiple parts because it's so beautiful, everything of the mother. And I think it's such a pity that many people are not even aware. Even people who are into Sri Aurobindo circles, they talk about Sri Aurobindo's works. They've heard about the Life Divine. They talk about the synthesis of yoga. Some of them venture into Savitri, many of them. But very few talk about words of the mother apart from the prayers and meditations. And personally to me, it was like a fire. Once I touched the mother's works, all the time I just couldn't help it. Whether in the bathroom or standing in a queue or train, I was just reading it. Because it's such a marvelous, she has touched upon everything in this universe, under the sun and beyond the sun. And several times, because there are questions, and based on the questions, she reveals different angles of the same truth. The other interesting part is that, see, 51 is volume 4, right? There is nothing like question and answer 1952. And the reason is that 52, she was taking French classes, translations. But there were a lot of informal discussions that went on. Unfortunately, it has not been recorded. There are also a number of informal discussions before 50. Some of them, as I said, Nalnida has recorded, but he himself says ki, this is not exactly my angle has come into it. So whatever it is, so the next is after 51, 1953. So who were attending these classes? One, the oldest sadhaks, people, Nalnida, etc., Pavitrada, who have been here for long, Amrita, and the school students. So you can imagine how the Divine Mother is relating, and because school students were there, the good part is that many of the questions and answers are so easily relatable, simply because children have asked these questions. And in detail, she goes on describing it. Sri Aurobindo's writings are impersonal. They come like a mighty Ganges. They are not addressed to this or that person. Letters on yoga later on. But that Sri Aurobindo is Sri Aurobindo. But the mother's writings are very personal. And when you read it, there is a different flavor. So they are helpful to mainly three categories of people. One is, of course, if you want to know about the path of the yoga of Sri Aurobindo and the mother, one has to read the mother's conversation. There is no other way. And there is a logic to it. Sri Aurobindo's words are written before the yoga is given to earth and men. They were there before 1920. There were no disciples who were taken at that point of time. So he had laid down the broad outline and the foundation of the yoga. Then from 26 onwards, we know that he basically through letters, and of course Savitri is a different thing altogether. So he responded to, because this is an unprecedented yoga. What may happen? It's one thing to know, okay, this is the route you go to Mount Everest, you climb. This one part. This is the route, you have to take a shepherd, you have to take or whatever helper and kandiwala and practice and train, and then you climb. It's quite another to have many unexpected, unprecedented things that happen on the way. It's a real adventure. So all those things that happen, for example, Sri Aurobindo, when he talks about human relationship, he'll give you a broad over. But there are people who are going through the real issue while they were engaged in yoga. So they would ask mother, they would ask and she would answer, and then in the conversation especially, 1951 onwards, because Sri Aurobindo had to undertake this supreme strategic sacrifice, she compressed the entire journey in these 6 or 7 volumes, primarily because she knew people have to be made ready, and she came down to everybody's level to make them ready. So this is one category. Second is people who are into traditional yoga, and they may like to understand a few things. And while she will not give us the details of you should sit like this, you should breathe like this, this has never been Sri Aurobindo and the mother's method. Yet, there is so much that they can learn and gather from here. And we'll touch upon one of the questions like that. And the third is general category of readers who just want to know what is sleep, what is dream, how to eat, how to rest, how to recuperate your energies, how to play. All this she has also revealed. Education, health, so many things. So one of the questions that I don't know whether it has occurred to people or not. It used to occur to me personally. There is also a letter in one of letters Sri Aurobindo. He says, I have seen many ashrams and the disciples everywhere. It is the same problem. People will give good lectures. They will look very impressive. They will people will introduce Swamiji and senior. But when it comes to the realizations, very few have had the genuine authentic experience, let alone realizations. Why does this happen? So, is there something which we are missing? And every time when I would look into it, I would understand the mother has repeatedly said, sincerity is the key. Sincerity is really missing. It is very difficult. And especially when one begins to profess that I am doing this and I am doing the yoga, people start giving you a lot of respect simply because you are supposed to be doing yoga or simply because your name is associated with the ashram. They start automatically thinking that you belong to this guru. So obviously something is there. Of course something is there without a doubt. But very few reach that point. But if I see the mother and Sri Aurobindo's disciples, I'm talking of the early disciples, I see that quite a few reached very far. There's not one or two, but quite a few. And one wonders that what is it that the mother gave them? She didn't give a method. She gave many methods. Left you free to pick up. But that one key word repeatedly, and sometime I want to take a complete talk on that because always I have looked within. This has been my issue to, that where is the insincerity? And that's where she takes up this question. It is one of the first questions and we'll start with that. It's 25th March 1953. And she says, question has been asked. Now questions have been asked based on 29 to 31 her writings which were already available by then. Nothing else she had, 51, yes, she had spoken things. So the disciple asks, you have said, you must be vigilant and see that you do not use the divine as a cloak for the satisfaction of your desires. How do we use it? One of them is, whatever comes into my life, mother has sent it. It is because of the mother. So naturally I accept because it is from the mother. So she says, many people accept certain theories, some of which are very convenient. And they say, everything is the result of the divine will. Very convenient. You have nothing to do. There is no effort, no choice, nothing. Everything is the result of divine will. Whatever is happening is from the mother. This is so dangerous because we have to differentiate between lower nature and higher nature. This too is divine mother, lower nature, but veiled. And that is the divine mother unveiled, Diti and Aditi. So if this choice was not required, then there is no sadhana required. Everything that is coming, every impulse, every suggestion, every thought, every desire, one can say everything that comes in life is coming from the divine mother. One can say it. She says it is very convenient. Others say the divine is everywhere and in everything and does everything. So this also people say. So somebody asked today, for example, that people ask this question that Rama and Krishna, they are the same and Sri Aurobindo is also same. I said, why you want to stop with that? If you talk about same in terms of divine presence, then you and me are also same. There is no difference. So the truth of oneness and the truth of differentiation. So this is how people misapply. The divine is everywhere in everything. And this they say as long as they don't get a blow. When the blow comes, then where is divine? Then you should say, okay, that's what the baby cat is. Baby cat makes no demands. Baby cat goes wherever the mother cat takes her. That's what baby cat is. Indeed, it is he who inspires me. Indeed, there are many theories and they say that. Naturally, their ego is as alive. This is called sincerity. You look into it and you will realize. They do all that they want to do, saying, it is the divine who is doing it in me. Whatever is supplied by their brain is the divine will. It is not a personal inspiration. Everything is the result of the divine will. It is not I who am acting. It is the divine who is acting through me. This is the problem with, that's why in long time earlier, this yoga was not given just like that. And mother says, now you have everything available in print. But I think the other day someone had posted that tests were taken earlier, whether you are ready or not, because the same teaching which can slay ignorance can equally slay you. It's like a sword, double-edged sword. If it falls on the other side, you are gone. People have lost their head in trying to follow. They do all that they wish to do. There are many people like that. Therefore, I said, do not use the divine as a pretty cloak to hide your desires. And people were so conscious earlier. See, our Chamalal ji shared this story, beautiful story. I used to have this dilemma, should I give a talk or not give a talk? And people, I had my own series of experiences repeatedly. But once you have this idea of asking some of these people who were doing it, what happened to you? So I asked one person, was Chote Narayan Sharma. So he said, because people say, no, all this is not mother's work. Mother's work is only within the ashram. He said, I don't know. When I came here, I asked mother, what work should I do? And Nalinda went to mother and mother told him, tell Chote Narayan he is writing and reading on Sri Aurobindo. Tell him to continue that. So I said, okay, this is fine, but it may apply to him. Then Chamanlal ji was telling the story that he had an invitation from US. And he asked the mother, mother, should I go or not? So mother asked, what do you want? He said, I don't know, mother, whatever you say. He said, no, what you want? Do you want to go? He said, as far as I can look inside, I don't think I want to go. Then mother mother told him that she knew ki somewhere there is something hidden. It is better you go because somebody has to represent mother and Sri Aurobindo. If you don't go, someone else will go and start representing. Same thing she did with Professor Manoj Das when he wrote something on life of Sri Aurobindo. And he said, if you don't write it, somebody else will write it. It's better that you write it. But she would make people conscious and use even those things for her work. So, then there is this question. The question is to be sincere. If you are not sincere, do not begin yoga. And the mother says, sincerity is perhaps the most difficult of all things. And perhaps it is also the most effective. So the letter you were quoting, you see there are three things Sri Aurobindo speaks of. First is strength, if it is spiritual, is a great power. A greater power is sincerity. And the greatest of all is, of course, grace. He says, so many times I have reminded you the saying of the Gita, Aham tva pape sarva pape bhyo mokshishyami masucha. So what is sincerity? She defines. If you have perfect sincerity, you are sure of victory. She has gone on to say, Sri Aurobindo has said, if you are integrally sincere, you will be transformed that very moment. The fact you are not means you are not sincere. And the greatest insincerity is to say, I am sincere. Sincere with reference to what? I am sincere to X, I am sincere to Y is irrelevant. Sincere with reference to the path that you have been given. So she says, it is infinitely difficult. Sincerity, now she's describing, sincerity consists in making all the elements of the being, all the movements, whether outer or inner, all the parts of the being, all of them have one single will to belong to the divine, to live only for the divine, to will only what the divine wills, to express only the divine will, to have no other source of energy than that of the divine. So many times, I can talk about myself, we catch ourselves. You want to watch a program on the TV. And you do it mechanically. Many actions are simply coming up from habitually. Or you want to listen to something, political news or something. Which may not be, it may be just a waste of time. and yet habitually, mechanically. So one day I was analyzing all this and saw many of the actions are subconsciously driven by habit, pure habit, mechanical. It's not given to the divine. It's not moved by the divine. And you feel that there is not a day, not an hour, not a minute when you do not need to intensify, rectify your sincerity, a total refusal to deceive the divine. The first thing is not to deceive oneself. Repeatedly she speaks about mental honesty. It's the first step. One knows one cannot deceive the divine. Even the cleverest of the asuras cannot deceive the divine. We know the story of Amal Kiran, how he learned when he made some painting and gave it to the mother. Mother says, this part is very beautiful. And he felt very ashamed because that was the part when he was constantly remembering and offering to the mother. She immediately gets it. You can't deceive the divine. She knows. I think I told that day, someone said, mother, but he is telling lies. After the person left, after telling a bundle of lies, mother laughed and said, I know it. You can't deceive the divine. She sees through, she knows. But even when one has understood that, one sees that quite often in one's life. In the course of the day, one tries to deceive oneself without even knowing it, spontaneously and almost automatically. And what is that? She reminds us, this is simple practice. People say, what is the practice of yoga? This is a very simple, elementary practice. And what is this practice? That is what happens first. I am not speaking of obvious things like quarreling and saying, it is the other one's fault. I am speaking of the very tiny things of daily life. I know a child who knocked against a door and he gave a good kick to the door. It is the same thing. It is always the other one who is wrong. This is the first basic necessity. Whether the other person is wrong or right is irrelevant actually. If you look at it, what is the only thing of relevance is my reaction, my response. That's all. Whether he's done right or wrong on whatever premise, I'm not here to do his sadhana. It is his between him and the divine. Maybe it was required that he says what he said because divine wanted me to listen to something to which my ears are closed. So repeatedly she says, Shubhendu puts it so beautifully in several places. One of the places where he says, when medieval ascetics blamed women for the fall, and I would rather think more kindly of God as well as women. Why blame anyone? Whatever is happening to me, I am responsible. How I am responsible? Maybe because of my attachment, maybe because of my desires, maybe because of my preferences, maybe because I want to appear good in the other person's eyes. 100 reasons. So we can't say because of X, Y, Z. This is what I call being sincere. When you are with someone, if you are sincere, instantaneously your way of reacting should be to do the right thing, even when you are with someone who does not do it. We speak words. We don't care about, you know, whether it is going to help, harm. We just say a very pleasant talk, yes, yes, nice. But if you are connected inwardly, you will speak the words which are necessary, which are good for you and good for everybody. Of course, you don't have to become rough, rude, obviously not. So, I tell you, if you look at yourself with sharp eyes, you will catch in yourself insincerities by the 100. Understatement. Even though you are trying to be sincere in your general attitude, you will see how difficult it is. For instance, you wake up in the morning, you want to write a prayer. I have seen myself. Is it a sincere prayer? Or is it you have to write a prayer? It's mechanically, like something you have to write. So then you wait for that prayer to come from the heart, from the depths. So everything like that. I tell you, if you are sincere in all the elements of your being, to the very cells of your body, and if your whole being integrally wants the divine, you are sure of victory. That is what I call being sincere. When I say, if you are sincere, you are sure of victory, I mean true sincerity. To be constantly the true flame that burns like an offering. So constantly we should keep on looking here on that flame. That intense joy of existing only by the divine and for the divine. And feeling that without him nothing exists. That life has no longer any meaning. Nothing has any purpose. Nothing has any value. Nothing has any interest unless it is this call, this aspiration, this opening to the Supreme Truth, to all that we call the divine. The only reason for the existence of the universe. Remove that and everything disappears. This is the state we have to cultivate. Quite naturally, many things will just drop off, which we continue to hang out and hang around. I remember one of the, when I had come, I wanted to come, being in Air Force, it was not easy. So if a friend of mine who was also in Champaklalji's seva, so he was in nursing home, so I had a bit of an audience with him. He was not speaking, he was writing. So he told him, first he introduced me to him, saying, he is my friend. Champaklalji looks at him and says, writes, friend? I remember that word was so pregnant with such a profound meaning. I can never forget. Friend? Kaun hai friend? It's like, it was like, avidya ki nagri mein vidwan. Friend? Question mark. Anyways, this person explained, ki, okay, that's how he is friend. So, he wants to come here. Champaklalji went into a trance. Then he comes out and he asks two things. He wrote. One he wrote, married? Question mark. Fail ho gaya yahi par. Married. Okay. Any other problem? Then fortunately, mother so arranged that, you know, Kavita also turned to the mother. Otherwise, life can be a mess. Second, he asked, money? Air Force mein izzat hai. You have honor, prestige, but where is the money? You don't get that kind of money. So I realized that I have failed in outer criteria. Then he went into his trance, and after some time his face changed. He became like mother's. This used to happen to him. And he became just like mother, and he just gave very beautiful smile and blessings. Then I knew these two problems will be sorted out. They got sorted out in ways beyond. But see, this is how every small little thing, detail, that, you know, these people, that you belong only to the divine. Nothing else. Nobody else. You exist for the divine. If this were not there, your life will be meaningless, valueless. If that is the state, then yes. Okay. Then she speaks of different things. One of the two great dangers of the yoga, one of them is ambition. And she says, if you have ambition, don't take up yoga. Because it's a canker which eats you from inside. So it's like worm in the fruit. So ambition initially is not evident. But as the yoga proceeds, all these things come out. It may even be spiritual ambition to be regarded as a yogi. Once I asked Chotanarayanji, I was so happy to see him the other day also, I remember, wearing a nice full pant and a bush shirt, a normal shirt, half shirt. But in terms of his knowledge, he's the person who once told a Mahamandaleshwar, who was reading Astavakra Gita, and he said something not very pleasant about Sri Aurobindo. So Chotanarayanji remarked, aapke haath mein jo kitab hai, hum isko peeche se front page tak bata sakte. And he knew it. He said, I can recite this book from backward to forward. Basically to put him in its place. But he would move around like that, very intuitive person. So once I heard him say something very beautiful. Because he said, why he wears it. He said, otherwise people have this tendency to eulogize you. See, even putting a dress, a bearing, carrying yourself as if you are a sadhu or somebody who is a yogi, people knowingly, unknowingly, and Shivindu speaks about it in Synthesis of Yoga. And that you see here, how the mother has removed all these things. And once while coming up the Nainital slope, he was reciting so many things of Upanishads. And I was so happy when we reached there, there was a lot of people around. And I said, Chutnarayan ji, wo thoda phir se boliye na, bahut anand aaya tha. I felt so happy hearing those slokas from Isha, from the Upanishads. And they were all known to him well. They loved him, respected him. And I was actually youngest of all of them. Suddenly he says, sabke liye nahi hota hai. Now actually if you see, it can be very embarrassing. It can be very embarrassing. Is as good as saying you people don't deserve to listen to it. So I felt embarrassed, but he was cool about it. He didn't feel compelled to say or recite. So, okay, now we'll read something which is, I feel, very important, which we often miss out. Often we hear every yoga, meditation. Yoga is synonymous with meditation. You also have classes and courses on meditation in the name of integral yoga, okay? So let's hear what mother has to speak about it. Is there a special meditation in this yoga? Meditation vis-a-vis work. Several places he has said, but here she says with such clarity that you just can't forget it. So this is 13th May 1953. Among people who meditate, there are some who know how to meditate. Rest of the people say that they don't, most of the people don't know how to meditate. And she says, there are some who, when they are sitting in meditation, get into a state which they think very fine and delightful. But that's not meditation about. So she says, among people who meditate, there are some who know how to meditate, who concentrate not on an idea, but in silence, in an inner contemplation in which they say, they reach even a union with the divine, and that is perfectly all right. So you'll feel this wonderful. You know? So she continues. There are others, just a few, who can follow an idea closely and try to find exactly what it means. That too is all right. That's what Shubhendu recommends. All is, the divine is in all is in the divine is all. One of the highest idea for meditation. There are people who try to concentrate and enter into a kind of half-sleepy and in any case very tamasic state. She describes all these people. People who know how to meditate are very few in number. Besides, admitting that through much discipline and years of effort, you have in your meditation succeeded in coming into conscious relation with the divine presence. She is taking the highest possibility. Okay, you have found a way, you do meditate well, and you have come in contact with the divine presence. Evidently, that is a result. And this result should necessarily have an effect upon your character and your life. But this effect is very different according to individuals. There are cases in which the person is split into two in so radical a way that while in meditation, such people can enter into contact with the divine and obtain this supreme felicity of identification. But when they come out of this and lead their normal life, begin to live and act, they can be the most ordinary men with the most ordinary and sometimes even the most vulgar reactions. Stay away from those who, you know. Because in life you take the challenge of yoga. So she is saying that you should be careful. Not only sannyasis, particularly mother said, they can be very dangerous because they harbor all kinds of things inside them, suppress them. But here she is speaking of genuine people who meditate. And that's what we see in that famous was it Shankaracharya, where he describes four types of reactions in nature? Sri Aurobindo also says that people who realize the self but don't work upon their nature in the fields of nature, they can become balvat, like a child, unmatvat, like a mad person, or jadvat, like a inert stone, or pishachvat, like a ghoul. They behave like that. So it doesn't necessarily change. They do not think of others. So what, to what extent it can go? Thinking of themselves only, having all selfish reactions and wanting to organize their life for their petty personal well-being. They do not think of others at all and never do anything for anybody. Have no large idea. And yet in their meditation, they have had this contact. So she is making it very clear. They may have the contact, but it may change nothing. They may not have a large idea. They may remain selfish, sometimes even more selfish. Because if you are a Babaji teaching others, you have to be treated with all the respect and whatever adulation. They get pretty used to it. And that is why people who have discovered how very difficult it is to change this petty outer nature that one takes on along with the body, how difficult is it to transcend oneself, to transform one's movements, say, it is not possible. It is no use trying. Classic example. Of course, the greatest among those who have realized the divine. I would say the greatest among those who have realized the divine, Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda, about whom Sri Aurobindo himself said the day Sri Ramakrishna set his foot on the soil of India, the new dawn began to arise. Actually, Satyug started. It's there in his poem to the Ganges. He's not said in these many, but the Mons, God revealed the Mon. That's how he says. That by the banks of Ganges, the Kineshwar. And we all know that they had a very difficult side. Swami Vivekananda was known. He could throw himself in a frenzy. Anger, not frenzy. If he saw any injustice, he would be very annoyed. And he couldn't tolerate anybody saying anything about India. He would give a punch. Sister Nivedita didn't understand this side of him. So she asked Ma Sarada. And she said, no. That is because Divine Mother has put a little veil over him. Otherwise the fellow will run away. Veil of lower nature. But of course there is a higher nature which is not there. Embodying that is not there in traditional yoga. And these are those who are among the highest. Without a doubt. So she goes on to say, in any case, for me, my experience, which is sufficiently long, for it is now almost 53 years since I have been dealing with people, with their yoga, their inner efforts. I have seen much here and there, a little everywhere in the world. Well, I do not believe that it is by meditation that you can transform yourself. I am absolutely convinced of the contrary. Period. It doesn't leave any doubt, ambiguity. And she's talking of the best, not that people can't meditate, etc. That is anyways a category which is like a washout. So what should we do, mother? This like a... we thought meditation equal to yoga. So she says, and see, this is so much in line with the Gita and Sri Aurobindo's own teaching. Strangely, people don't talk about it. Everywhere, method of meditation. Even in name of Sri Aurobindo. But what they expect us to do, want us to do, cannot be taught. It's a question of our sincerity. She says, if while doing what you have to do, whatever it may be, whatever work it is, if you do it and while doing it, are careful not to forget the divine. Try that and see how difficult it is. To offer to him what you do and try to give yourself to him, that he may change all your reactions. That means we have to first be vigilant and observe, what are my reactions? Instead of their being selfish, so what are those reactions we have to change? Selfish, petty. These are two things which Sri Aurobindo repeatedly says. Selfishness and meanness. They are the only sins I find difficult to pardon, and yet they are universal. Therefore, these two must be pardoned. selfishness and meanness, pettiness, thinking only about oneself, not about, you know, petty, stupid and ignorant, making them luminous, generous. So you'd see these parts, make them luminous, make them generous. Then in that way you will make progress. You have to see what is that part which is shrinking within, thinking only of oneself, one's own advantage, how to take advantage. Mother says at one place, she says, it's not meeting people that tires me. But there is this group of humanity which just wants to pull, want. But when it comes to giving, there is nothing. Not that the divine depends on their giving, but you form a contact, you progress. That is the whole secret. She will give because that's her nature. Not only will you have made some progress, but you will have helped in the general progress. I have never seen people who have left everything in order to go and sit down in a more or less empty contemplation. For it is more or less empty. I have never seen such people making any progress. Or in any case, their progress is very trifling. What more, how much more categorical can it be? I have seen persons who had no pretensions of doing yoga. It is so beautiful when you meet such people. They don't say, we are doing yoga, we are doing sadhana. But who were simply filled with enthusiasm by the idea of terrestrial transformation and of the descent of the divine into the world. Mother speaks about it even later on. Just this feeling the divine has sacrificed himself in matter for its redemption. This faith, that's enough. He says, those, the joy, the enthusiasm that the divine has come upon earth. And maybe, you know, like a Guillory or something, we would participate. And of the descent of the divine into the world. And who did their little bit of work with that enthusiasm in the heart. Giving themselves wholly, without reserve, without any selfish idea of a personal salvation. When will I get transformed? What experience I will have? What realization I'll have? Okay, nothing. End of the story. The only thing we should be concerned with, how much I have given myself and how much is yet to be given. And there's always something to give. Mother says there is always something to give because you can give the same thing in a better way. So, these I have seen making magnificent progress, truly magnificent. And sometimes they are wonderful. I have seen sannyasis. I have seen people who live in monasteries. I have seen people who profess to be yogis. Well, look what she's saying. Well, I would not exchange one of the others for a dozen such people. She says the same thing in Collected Works of Mother, Volume 12. That I would not exchange these who are sincere, simple, who are ready to work and offer themselves for those who claim that they are big yogis and big people and big sadhaks who can. So the disciple, ek se ek hai na, he wants to be very clear. So meditation is of no use, question. Naturally, you know, he wants to be sure. So meditation is of no use. Mother says, no, and to the extent it is necessary, it will come spontaneously. All of a sudden, you will be seized by something that makes you still, makes you concentrate in the vision of an idea or of a psychological state that captures you. You must not resist. Then you make the needed progress. This is what I was referring to. From everything you see a divine disclosure, like that picture. Everything will disclose to you something of the divine. Then there is a inner joy, felicity, some, it's like an aha feeling. And it goes on like that. What I most fear are those who believe themselves very exceptional because they sit down and meditate. Of all things, this is the most dangerous. Because they become so vain and so full of self-satisfaction that they close up in this way all avenues of progress. There is one thing that has always been said but always misunderstood. It is the necessity of humility. And then she describes humility and vanity. I have seen my little contact, at least with Champak Lal ji. Suddenly he would feel and then he would go into meditation. One day he would just, he was staying in Shrivinda's room, just go there and sit and because he just wants to sit there and obviously meditation. Sometime while eating he would go into meditation. It's such a joy just to be near. But it's not like a fixed time. Of course we have to discipline ourselves is one thing. But we must know the real truth. And we should not think, oh, I am meditating so much. So she goes on such wonderful things in this. She speaks about what is offering and what is surrender, aspiration, self-giving, and how we should learn to step back. Then there is one question somebody has asked, very interesting. Perceiving the divine in everything. So what do people normally think? Oh, you will see a form. For instance, you will see Sri Aurobindo and the mother physically everywhere. Isn't it? That's how people most are seeing the divine in everything. She says, no, it's not necessary at all. Because this means you are seeing it with still the mind. So the form the divine takes is according to your mind. But it's the sense of the presence. Presence is something very interesting when we speak about feeling the presence. First time when I had heard this word, it had like shaken me. Presence. What is this presence? It's not defined. Presence, the divine presence. We wonder, what is presence? Is it a form? Is it something? But it's a presence, literally a presence. You can feel it. Its effects you can see. And you can see when it is veiled. You can see when it seems to be eclipsed. And you know when it is there. And Sri Aurobindo describes this in Savitri that its presence made the smallest actions great. Its absence left the greatest acts, smallest seemed divine, and its absence left the greatest actions dull. So one will know it, you know, if that moments when life is very dull, you may do everything, go to ashram, go to the department, but everything is dull. But there are others when this presence is active and everything is so full of joy, inner felicity, peace, beatitude, you don't get angry, you don't, of course one should never get angry, but you know all those negative emotions, fear and all those things just don't come because you are in that state of presence. So she describes when she comes to the divine grace and karma, someone asks a question that some say that the law of karma is ineluctable, some say it can be changed, what is your view? She says, my child, grace can completely annul karma. Even you yourself, by persistent effort, can annul the karma. There is nothing like a fixed law. And the grace, it can completely change karma. She says in beautiful, I'll just maybe read just a line from there. It's a beautiful phrase. The disciple asks, first he says, how nature plays. She says, it gives you three illusions. They are needed for your progress. First illusion is that though she is putting, but the first illusion is that you are the doer. The second illusion is that because you are the doer, you must make the choices. And the third illusion is because you have made the choices, you are going to suffer or get the consequences. She says, there is nothing like that. Nature is doing. And yet you have to follow that. You have said here that we are tied to the chain of karma. But then sometimes when the divine grace acts, that contradicts. Mother says, completely. The divine grace completely contradicts karma. You know, it makes it melt away like butter that's put in the sun. She goes on to say even what is called as utkat karma, which means suicide and murders. They are the only two utkat karma. Murder, not a soldier on the battlefield, not like that. These are two karmas which chase you for 3 to 7 lives. Even they can be dissolved by the grace. And she says very interestingly, when the time comes for it to go away, you normally become conscious in one way or the other of that central problem. And she says then, just a little aspiration is required. or just faith that grace can dissolve the karma and it can be dissolved. So these are very unique things which you, if you read from tradition regarding prayer and aspirations, he says something interesting. Aspiration can be with or without formulation. It's an inner state. You may give words to it, or you may not give words to it, but prayer always is something more external. You give words. And he says both are necessary. There are people who, you need humility to pray. It means there's someone who can grant you prayer. But aspiration is what modern mind accepts more readily. You aspire, you... And there's a very beautiful thing about adverse forces. So we keep blaming the world. Adverse forces is attacking, hostile forces is attacking. And people have also used now Mother's Mantra. It was for a specific purpose in a specific way, but it's okay. Anybody, you know, it's Mother's words. But what we have to do? She says adverse forces attack, they can attack, but what you have to do is to look inside, where is the chink in the armor within you? They will cause, one of the commonest action of adverse forces is depression. Making you feel life is not worth it, yoga is not worth it, I am unfit, etc., etc. Better for me to go away. This is the sign of adverse forces attacking you. And of course they can cause physical illness also. But we have not to worry, oh, either say this person is sending adverse force, that is a absolutely absurd thing. What we have to see is that what is it in me which is opening to the adverse forces? It could be an intense attachment. If you are attached to someone or something, it could be an intense desire. It could be ambition. Most of all, fear. These are the four things. Which sexual, excessive sexuality. These are things which open the door to the attack by adverse forces. And of course, when they come, we keep on blaming. But their role is to, they are originally meant to show us where are our defects. But where they have become adverse, Mother says, because they don't believe in grace. So not only will they attack you, make you do foolish things or bring that state of depression or whatever, but they will make you feel guilty. And they will make you feel it is impossible. I am a gone case, I am a nut case. Nut case is still okay, gone case, all are nut case. And they will make you feel unfit. This yoga is not for me, better to go away. See, I have got nothing after staying so many years. It means you are thinking of yourself and you came here to get something. So that time you have to catch, what is it? Is it prompted by some ambition, something? And they will come out because this is the action of truth. You can't hide it. Outside one can hide it, but here you cannot hide it. And when it comes, if we don't have the humility and the vigilance, we try to cover it. Even there is a justification. Everybody is doing it, therefore it is fine with me. So it's better to see things how they are. You know that joke about Satyajit Ray, when he came here and wanted to stay here, he said, I have only one problem. What is your problem? He says, my problem is about the career. He wants a career, ambitious man. The sadhak doesn't understand career. That is very simple. That day you become ashram inmate, you will get a career. In fact, two, cycle career as well as tiffin career. To see, at least the man is honest that, well, I have ambition. Not to cover it and then to express it using the divinest cloak. And she says they come because of affinity. So what we should do when they come? So if the attack comes, you must keep perfectly quiet and send it back, which includes illnesses. Not to be afraid, not to start vibrating, not to condemn oneself, not to be guilty. None of these things. Stay quiet, call the mother, send it away. Even if 100,000 times, and Mother says, find out what is it in us which is opening the doors. You have to put a seal there. Divine fevicol. Bilkul. Nothing. And that seal is only Mother's name in that part. Whenever that part rises up, that time, ma, ma, ma. Don't express it. Don't rush to. So one, the more one does it slowly, it gets sealed. There is a way, you see, when the force comes, rushes out to meet it, the adverse force, when it attacks, the part which corresponds, rushes out to meet it, it goes forward. A kind of meeting takes place. See, it comes usually as an impulse. And after we have said, maybe anger or whatever, then it's already late. We've done things and it has done what it wanted to do. It has taken its pound of flesh. If at that time, instead of being altogether overwhelmed or taken by surprise and off your guard, you observe very closely what it was within you that vibrated. It makes the sound, tat, tat, tat. Another thing has entered. Then you catch it. At that moment you catch it and say to it, get out with your friends, I don't want you any longer. For that you must be very vigilant. And she says, persevering. You have to do it number of times. It's not like one day. That's why it takes long. Otherwise, very simple. Learn a technique, meditate, finished. But its change of nature takes long. And then, of course, there are some beautiful things about sleep and dream, causes and cure of fear, how our ill will has an effect, how a bad thought is like a... She says, our thought and will and feelings are as powerful action as our physical actions. Very few, when they talk about law of karma, people talk only about outer action. But inwardly, our ill will, our ill feeling, all this has an effect. And then finally she says something. Finally means we'll take the rest in the second part. She speaks about the psychic being and rebirth. How it happens. This I'll read. Several places she has revealed this mystery of the psychic being. Actually, one thing she says, when the psychic chooses where it will come, which psychic being can choose, which has developed into a being. Before that, you are under all kinds of forces. She says, but the psychic will and psychic growth escape completely all common notions of justice, of reward and punishment as men understand them. It's not like a psychic being born in a poor family means, are developed nahi hoga. For all you know, it may be more developed. And at one place he says that it has been said, and rightly so in the Bible, that it's much more difficult to make a camel. It is easier to make a camel pass through the eye of a needle than to make a rich man turn to God. It's so true. It grips you. Very difficult, because your mind is living in Dehatmbodh. So she says people have all these ideas and stories, but it's not like that. A large number of people come and tell me, what then have I done in my previous life to be now in such difficult conditions with such misfortunes happening to me? And most often I am obliged to tell them, but don't you see that it is a blessing upon you, a grace? And perhaps in your previous life you have asked for it so that you could make a greater progress. These ideas are quite current. Oh, I am ill. Oh, my body is in a bad condition. What have I done? What crime have I committed in the other life so that in this one? And then she says, this is all childishness. Authority. One last bit that she speaks about, the three stages of development of the psychic being. So first is, there are in the psychic being two very different kinds of progress. So first is where it is developing from a little spark to a full-fledged psychic being. So that requires one kind of development and experience. The psychic being at its origin is only a spark of the divine consciousness, and it is through successive lives that it builds up a conscious individuality. It is a progress similar to that of a growing child. It is a thing in the making. For a long time, in most human beings, the psychic is a being in the making. It is not a fully individualized, fully conscious being and master of itself, and it needs all its rebirths one after another in order to build itself and become fully conscious. So this idea that I want to discover my psychic being, first of all, is there a developed psychic being? Or is it still? So the first step should be not I want to discover my psychic being, but I want to grow the psychic individuality. The psychic is still little baby in the womb. It must develop into a psychic being. But this sort of progress is an end. There comes a time when the being is fully developed, fully individualized, fully master of itself and its destiny. How do we know this? When this being or one of these psychic beings has reached that stage and takes birth in a human being, that makes a very great difference. The human being, so to say, is born free. Nothing really binds. He is born like with a mission, with a work which has been given by the divine. He has come consciously to participate in this work. He is not tied to circumstances. Put him anywhere, he will reach that destiny, which is bequeathed. He is not tied to circumstances, to surroundings, to his origin and atavism like ordinary people. Mera gaon, mera desh, meri mami, mere papa. I mean, all this goes away. Because you are not, psychic being makes you free actually. You no more, you cannot be constrained into this statehood and parenthood and all this. It just goes, even your tradition in which you are born, all this will just go away. You are born in some tradition where you pick up what is required. Maybe some seed of bhakti, something. After that, all the rest is washed away because it's not needed. He comes into the world with the purpose of doing something, with a work to carry out, a mission to fulfill. From this point of view, his progress in growth has come to an end. That is, it is not indispensable for him to take birth again in a body. So the indispensable part is still you are in ignorance. After you are free, then it's up to you to take the next course or not. Till then, rebirth is necessary because it's through this that we develop. But once he is fully formed, he is free in this sense that he can take birth or not at will. So there, one kind of progress stops. But if this fully formed being wants to become an instrument of works for the work for the divine, if instead of retiring to repose in a psychic bliss in its own domain, he chooses to be a worker upon earth to help in the fulfillment of the divine work. It's a very conscious choice such a psychic being makes, and it becomes aware of its mission. As the mind develops a little bit, it becomes aware of this mission. Then he has a fresh progress to make, a progress in the capacity for work, for organization of his work and for expression of the divine will. So there is a time when the thing changes. So long as he remains in the world, so long as he chooses to work for the divine, he will progress. Only if he withdraws into the psychic world and refuses to continue doing the divine work or renounces it, can he remain in a static condition outside all progress. So this is the destiny. First step is when psychic being is developing through rebirths, through the experiences of ignorance, experience that we call as good and bad, sweet and bitter, and fortune, misfortune, good luck, bad luck. Through everything it grows. Then a time comes when it grown fully, it becomes conscious of itself. Automatically it becomes conscious of itself. And then it is free. It need not come. It has finished the schooling. And certificate has been given, higher secondary, passed. We have the ceremony and graduation done. But it may choose to come for the divine work. And then it comes very consciously, takes place, birth in an environment where it will develop all that is necessary for the work that it is born to do. That's how its whole journey will be like that. And that's another line of progress, quite naturally. As Shobindu says, the higher lines of karma, when you are not only free, but the Shobindu's yoga begins after that. But you start manifesting higher and higher levels of consciousness, which even a Jivan Mukta may not express because he is free. Or rather, a Mumuksh will not express. And then free being enters, takes up the work. That's the second kind of progress. And of course, these people do have a special protection, special grace, because they are basically free. And the Divine Mother walks with them at very consciously at every step. So these are the two kinds of progress, and so many more things we'll read next time.